It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We focus now on our state's cheesemakers. They received about one quarter of all awards given at this year's American Cheese Society Judging and Competition National Conference held in Portland, Oregon last month. To put it into perspective, Wisconsin dairy artisans took home about twice the awards won by the next state, California. So join in on Wisconsin cheesemaking traditions. What sets our state apart? 800-642-1234. Marika Penterman is CEO of Marika Gouda in Thorpe. She's a U.S. champion cheesemaker, herd of 400 dairy cows, and her signature cheese is Marika Gouda. Marika, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, everyone. So I'm very excited to be here on public radio. So thank you for having me.
Yes. Thanks for being here. And you took home 9 awards this year. You're a decorated cheese award winner now. Which award this year were you most proud of?
Well, we had a whole bunch, and I have to say, I'm just proud of the fact that all our cheeses won an award. So, and that says a lot because the quality of cheeses through the years became, they are very hard to compete with, and I like to win.
You have that competitive streak in you.
Yes, I noticed, unfortunately.
I noticed that jalapeno was an ingredient in a bunch of winning cheeses. You also had a cheese that was recognized with jalapeno peppers. And how do you make jalapenos not overpower the natural taste of the cheese?
That's a very good question because it is in the beginning when the cheese is smooth and creamy, you will taste the flavor more. And as the cheese ages more, then the flavor of the cheese will shine a little bit through the flavoring. So to balance flavor and cheese is very hard. And then on top of it, we also have then when we enter into competition, one of the comments of the judges will always be like, too much condiments. And but then you have people that sample it in your store in Thorpe, Wisconsin, and they will say, I could use a little bit more of jalapeno or a little bit more onion and garlic. So it's always trying to find that the perfect balance between everything. But I think we kind of nailed it. And when we don't, because we have a really good cranberry horseradish, then we try to adjust. But we also have a wonderful Marika Gouda bacon that we make with Nolchek bacon in Thorpe. And I have to say that bacon is my second or third kind of favorite food. So I might have done that a little bit too much. And then the curd doesn't want to stitch so well together. So we kind of had to reduce on a bacon. So it's a work in progress and you always have to keep trying. So
I would be open to trying those jalapeno cheese curds. I saw that was a winner. Did you happen to try those? I think they were from Davenport, Iowa.
You know, we have our own jalapeno cheese curd, so why would I want to try something else? No, I'm kidding. It's always, we love trying other cheeses. So I'll order sometimes cheeses from other cheesemakers, and it's just always good to expand your taste buds and see what other people do. So
know the competition out there.
There is sure competition and that keeps you sharp too. So it makes you want to do better and for sure keep you on your toes.
Well, what a pleasure as we talk about award-winning cheese with none other than Marika Penterman. She is CEO of Marika Gouda in Thorpe. You can join in with your cheese-making questions, your favorite Wisconsin cheeses, and why. 800-642-1234. Marika, Gouda cheese has that sweet and buttery and that, you know, that nutty flavor to it. Is that from the cows? How does it get that flavor?
It definitely all starts with the cows. So, and I have to say very proudly that what sets us aside from other cheeses is that we are farmstead. That's one of the things, which means that we have the cows right on the farm here in Thorpe, Wisconsin. So when people come and visit us, because that's what they can come and see our cows and you can see how we milk them. They can cuddle with the calves. We do tours at 9 and 1 o'clock during the summer months when we have our college kids with us that are wonderful tour guides. And yeah, but I think it's all starting with the cow. And I know that there are other states in this country that claims that they have happy cows. But if they have happy cows, we have extremely happy cows. And Gouda, even for the ones that when it's young, and they want a little bit more of a bite to it, we do have some very limited edition of an aged Gouda, so that's more than 2-3 years old, and that has a little bit more of a crunch to it, and the caramel flavor comes through it. So,
I was going to ask, what is the difference between tasting young Gouda versus aged Gouda?
Well, and that is so fun. Well, the Gouda is so wide. It's everybody has its flavor in whatever age we have it. So young and creamy in the beginning. And those are very good for on our grilled Gouda. So we have a little cafe where people can come and taste our cheese in some different dishes. But our grilled Gouda is one of our favorite. Mm. And you can add some bacon again to it or jalapeno for certain people that can handle the heat. And yeah, but if you want to just enjoy it in the evening with a glass of wine or just water, our aged Gouda is very good. And then we have a mustard in our store that we import from Holland called Erwin the Mustard Man. And that has a little bit of a sweetness and a crunch to it. Again, yeah, there's everything you can try. And then we have the different flavors. So again, bacon, mustard. Fenugreek is our first award winner and it won many, many, many awards. So, and that has a little bit of a nutty taste to it. So there's for everybody a flavor.
Just transport me to Thorpe. That's all I need. Well, Marika, you were born and raised in the Netherlands and, you know, Gouda, one of the oldest surviving types of cheese in the world. I wonder what that did to you, like growing up on a dairy farm and really learning by watching as a child about cheese making.
Yeah. So when you love cows, people always ask me, how did you end up in Wisconsin? Well, if you love cows and that's what we do, where else could you end up? Wisconsin. And after a while, Rolf and his brother, both they were the first one to come and they started farming over here. And after a while, and we have 5 beautiful children. And if you come and visit us in Thorpe, you might probably end up seeing 1 or 2 because they all are hands-on. I just wanted to start something for myself. And growing up in Holland, I went to the supermarkets, found all these beautiful cheeses, including cheese curds, which I never had seen in my life before. But I couldn't find Gouda. So we investigated the options and I'm like, that's the route. I have a problem and I wanted to start my own business before I turned 30. I did not have, I would ask family and friends if they could bring along cheese and restriction by custom got tougher. So they had to choose between Gouda or their own clothes. So I always lost that battle. we started and we had the good Wisconsin milk. We had the cows on the farm and I went back to Holland and learned how to make Gouda over there. I just did 2 days to see at 2 different cheesemakers and came home and we started making cheese on 22 November 2006 after I got the cheesemaker's license because Wisconsin is the only state on planet Earth so far I know that is requiring a cheesemaker's license.
And a fraction of our state's licensed cheesemakers are women. 3 are working for Marika Gouda. How could the industry maybe better support women in the business and getting into it?
I do think that Wisconsin is very open-minded that way. And I'm just very fortunate that it's such a camaraderie in the cheese industry and the dairy business. And I feel like we just have to promote it better. And I'm just very happy that I have 2 women in my team that also went out and got the cheesemaker's license while working at our plant. And I'm just very proud of that. So I'm just glad that we became such a team inside and outside the house and that we all have no equal equal rights to do so. So, and that it's just more determined by your drive. Yeah, I'm very fortunate.
Marika Penterman with us, champion cheesemaker, business owner, farmer in Thorpe, Wisconsin, with the happiest cows. As we talk about the accolades of Wisconsin dairy producers and the work of crafting more varieties and types and styles of cheese. Join in on cheesemaking in our state, what you notice and love, how you interact with the industry, what is on your cheese board and why. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin leads the nation in cheese production. Comparing all states, we contribute a quarter of our nation's cheese, according to the latest data from the first half of this year, analyzed by the trade group Dairy Farmers of Wisconsin. Join in on standards for cheese making, the process of making it, what sets our state apart from other artisans, and your favorite Wisconsin cheese. 800-642-1234. We have award-winning cheesemaker and business owner Marika Penterman stays with us. Marika, you sell cheese at different stores around the country, California, Texas, Pennsylvania. Which market is the biggest for Marika Gouda?
Well, I would definitely say the Midwest, of course. We love our cheeses. So we are true cheese heads. And we in Holland, we are called cheese heads, too. So I feel very home here.
How do you store Gouda when you can't eat it all? I've heard the cheese likes to breathe.
That's right. So when we started making Gouda, because it's very different than cheddar, and that's kind of funny because my neighbor, when we started making Gouda, it was so unknown. He says, Marika, what is Gouda? So I had to explain him what Gouda was. And his second question was, are there enough Dutch people that will eat it? Like, yes, of course, you are too. But one of the things with Gouda is like it's a water wash curd. So in the morning, we get our cheese from our own cows. So there is a the farm and the creamery is connected with a culvert and a pipeline under the ground. So the milk comes straight from the farm into our cheese vat. And then one of the differences, it's a water wash curd. So after we add our cultures to it and our rennet and it coagulates the milk, we start cutting it after 30 minutes. And then you will see that the solid part, the curd, and then the liquid part, the whey, is separating from each other. We drain some of the whey, and then we add hot water to it. So we raise the temperature. Mm-hmm. And then after, depending on from Gouda cheesemakers, the differences, you can play with your water, the temperatures, the length, the volume. So there's different ways, and you can add your own cultures to it. And when the curd is ready, we pump it into our drain table where we cut blocks out of it, and those blocks go into a round mold. So there is a different of shape also. We don't add salt in with our curd, but we let the cheese soak up its own salt. So after 2 hours of pressing, our cheese goes into a brine, and it goes in for 60 hours. So and after those 60 hours, it goes into an aging room, and it's not a cooler. Our aging room is between 50 and 55 Fahrenheit, and it's around 80% of humidity. So it's a different way of aging, and going back to your question, it's breathing. So we have a warmer temperature in our aging room, and that's where a lot of stuff happened, is in the aging room. So we will take our wheels, all our cheeses get flipped twice a week. We take the cheese, we flip it, clean it with water and vinegar, put it on a clean, sanitized shelf. And as the cheese ages, it will lose its moisture. And we have a kind of a para coating that will let the moisture go through the coating. It's not a wax, because wax will kind of like doesn't let the cheese breathe. But it's very important that we continue flipping our cheeses. So there's a lot of labor involved. So
how would you suggest that we store it at home in our refrigerator? What do we wrap it in?
Of course, you shouldn't store it. You should just eat it. It's the best consumed on room temperature. And in the earlier days, if you think about it, we made cheese to preserve milk. So it's actually a preservative. And people often would leave it out. Well, there's nothing wrong with that, to leave some cheese out. I will even leave sometime cheese out. I have a hard time committing the cheese to put it in the refrigerator, like no more eating it. But if you are, you can put it in. There's special paper with a little line of cheese paper in it inside, but I, to be honest, sometimes I just grab a Ziploc bag, and that's totally fine too. Or cheeses, you can buy it vacuumed and it will stay forever. So when my parents would come and bring the cheese, it would be in the suitcase for at least 3-4 days, or sometimes maybe even longer, because, well, when you travel, sometimes you pack your suitcase already a week ahead if you don't travel often, which happened with my parents. So it would be in the suitcase for quite a while. And the cheese will remain to stay good.
We have champion cheesemaker Marika Penterman, our guide to cheese in Wisconsin, and her approach. You can join in 800-642-1234. Kimberly is with us in Arena. Kimberly, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Hi, good morning. So I grew up Holland, Michigan. My family's very Dutch. And one cheese that I rarely ever find in Wisconsin is a Dom cheese, and I was wondering if you guys have ever considered making that or making it in the future.
A Dom cheese, Marika.
Do you make? Do you mean Edam?
Yes. Yeah. Sorry.
Edam.
Edam cheese. Okay. Yeah. So Edam cheese is unlike Gouda, but then a low fat Gouda. At this point, we don't standardize our milk, so we would have to take the fat out of the milk and then add a little bit back to it. But we don't do it. We use whole milk. So whatever the cows give us, and they give wonderful milk, is what we use. So in order to do that, we would have to make a little bit of adjustments. But I would definitely not exclude that down the road in our future.
Kimberly, thank you for that question. I'm wondering, Marika, how does a person approach a cheese board? How do you think about assembling the cheeses and what to include? Because you mentioned mustard earlier.
Yes. So first of all, you start with Marika Gouda, of course. And you can pick any flavor you want. No, it's nice to pick different cheeses. The cheeses that you like, of course. We have a spread, which is very nice, with a cracker on a cheese board. It brings variety. Then our mustard dill dip. It's nice to do a dill, a mustard, but I would also include a jam. I would take some nuts, included with that. So there's a lot of nice options. You cut it up, and I wouldn't even worry too much about the presentation. You live and learn, and every time it gets even more creative and beautiful. At the end, when I make a pie, I'm telling you, it's horrible, but it tastes wonderful. And that's what people remember, the cheeses on your board.
It's about the taste.
Well, yes, and the brie is really good.
I'm going to squeeze in another call here. Dwayne in Weston is with us. Dwayne, what would you like to bring up about Gouda?
About Gouda, yeah. When I was doing a lot of demoing of food, we did Gouda mashed potatoes, and we would shred smoked Gouda into the potato, mashed potatoes, you know, give them a stir, put some more, and then bake them. This was around the holidays. I had more comments from any flavor demos. It was just so amazing, you know, and then with cheese too. And I mean, most people know this, but is you let it get up to room temperature, you know, don't just get out the fridge, cube it, and slice it and eat it. Just let it, if you're going to have cheese all night, let it sit out for 20 minutes, half an hour, and get up to room temperature. You're going to get way, way more flavor out of each
leaving cheese, it out a bit. Yes, Dwayne, thank you for that. Marika, have you ever made smoked Gouda mashed potatoes?
Yes, we did. And a matter of fact, we have an amazing smoked Gouda. We do it with natural smoking. So we don't add liquid smoking to it. So you can, well, like there's a difference between that. There's a big difference between it. And our smoked Gouda ended up fifth at the World Cheese Competition. And that for a flavored cheese is pretty well. But yeah, the smoked, you can do so many wonderful. We even have a smoked cumin, which shredded on tacos or chili is really good.
Marika, thank you for joining us.
Yes, well, thank you for having me on your show. This was wonderful. And I hope everybody has a good day. And please come visit us in Thorpe, where you can see how we make our cheese and milk our cows and cuddle with a cow. Okay. So I hope to expect you soon sometime.
Thank you. A good day to you too. Marika Penterman, CEO of Marika Gouda in Thorpe, Wisconsin. And ahead this hour, we move from cheese to mustard. We got a sample there on the cheese tray. We talk with the leader of a Berlin, Wisconsin-based mustard manufacturer about recent shortages. Join in on mustard, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In recent months, France has been gripped by a Dijon mustard shortage. It's a French household staple condiment that has all but disappeared from that country's grocery store shelves. We get perspective from a Wisconsin mustard manufacturer on market pressures, on mustard seed cultivation, harvest. Join in all things mustard, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Alan Sass is here, president of Wisconsin Spice, Inc., based in Berlin, providing dry milled and prepared mustards for industrial, food service, and retail sectors of the food industry. Alan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. What is the situation with Dijon mustard and this mustard shortage? What do you know?
Well, it's certainly while Europe, France specifically, and the Dijon mustard type of condiment has seemed to garner the most attention, it's really, I would say, grappled the entire industry and all types of mustard. It's just a matter of really where we see it. What happened is we were subject to the 2021 crop year, that is. So as you may know, most of the mustard seed that is supplied to the world is actually sourced out of North America, with most of that coming from the Western Canadian prairies. And we experienced, just like most crops, a significant drought last year, effectively cut total stocks coming out of the 21 crop year, which, you know, would have been harvested last August, September, and is expected to carry us through until this upcoming or ongoing 2022 crop year harvest. But effectively, total stocks coming out of the 21 crop year across all types of mustard seed was about 60% of what normal annual and historical consumption is. So just to kind of put in some perspective, typically the world consumes about 150,000 metric tons of mustard seed that is sourced from Canada. Coming out of the 21 crop year, there was about 90,000 metric tons available. And I think that number might be a little bit inflated based on some of the anecdotal evidence we've been able to receive.
Scientists are also warning that climate change could lead to more frequent and severe droughts in the Canadian prairies, like you described, and it could affect future crop yields. Would that require you to change perhaps how you do business in decades to come?
It certainly would be a shock to the system. It without a doubt would be. Going back last year, there's a little more to the story beyond just the kind of, I would say, snapshot of 2021. I mean, of course, it's easiest to cite the quantitatives around what, you know, really how bad it was just based on the 2021 crop year. But really, the dry conditions that mustard seed and a number of these crops have been experiencing and have been exposed to, it really isn't anything new. It's been dry for years prior. I think this last year just hit another level of drought that kind of pushed it over the precipice, so to speak. The other thing that affected mustard, and I think a number of other specialty crops like mustard, whether it's sunflower seeds, has garnered a lot of attention as well, is that it really was underplanted going back to the 2020 crop year. So, there's certainly, we can, say that, climate is changing and that certainly is going to have an effect. But, given, I would say, the dramatic, reality we're living in this last year with shortages, we can really go back a couple of years earlier where mustard seed was really underplanted, really, I would say, perhaps undersupported by the industry, whether that was in terms of pricing. Quite frankly, going back to the 2020 crop year, growers just didn't see a lot of incentives in planting mustard seed. They just didn't see the returns in it. And I think there's, a bit of a market failure in that in terms of not recognizing what values, growers needed and were looking for. Certainly, they have a lot of pressure with rising costs, rising fertilizer costs, and just, rising costs to do their business. And really, we had a really low production year going back to 2020, which put us into a situation going into 2021 where there was very limited carryover, historically speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And then, again, 2021 saw underwhelming acreage, largely due to pricing pressure from other commodities. And you sprinkle in a drought, so yields that were about 50% of the historical average. So again, certainly, we can look at 21 in a snapshot and say it certainly pushed us over the edge because, again, yields were about 50% of what the historical average, in fact, less than 50%.
Sounds like there were
average.
It sounds like there were compounding factors in addition to the drought. Yes,
absolutely. And we haven't even touched on the impact, the Ukraine
war in
Russia war has had.
Yeah.
That's a very large mustard growing region, one that certainly Europe does depend on quite heavily. And so I think that's why we're hearing a bit more of the shelf shortages and empty shelves in Europe, maybe a little bit more pronounced than we are here in the States, because, I don't know that there's many North American mustard manufacturers who depend on Eastern Europe mustard seed. But certainly in Europe, it figures to be a large portion of their supply. And it was, the degree of which is debatable, but I don't think anyone could argue that it certainly does have an impact on supplies for that market.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the challenges facing the mustard industry with Alan Sass. He's president of Wisconsin Spice Incorporated and supplies mustards for various industrial and commercial uses. You can join in on how you use mustard, how you want to know about how it's produced or what it goes into the seed. 800-642-1234. Alan, aside from mustard that lands on hot dogs or burgers, what are some lesser-known ways that mustard is used in our food supply?
Yeah, so it's actually one of the largest applications, actually, if we look at how much mustard seed is actually grown versus how it is processed, is one of the largest applications is actually dry milled mustard powders, whether that be whole ground mustard or mustard flour. It's really used in a variety of food applications. And companies like ourselves, we supply it around the world for applications in dressings and sauces, mayonnaise. I would say the majority of any processed meat, particularly hot dogs, around the world, uses mustard actually as an ingredient for its functional purposes that go beyond flavor. So it is really, goes well beyond the condiment that we see on the shelf in terms of its dependence on supply.
When you say it goes into a product's functional purposes beyond flavor, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, good question. So I would say, mildly approaches from a technical standpoint. Mustard is actually a very strong and very, very effective emulsifier. It's a very it has a high content of protein as well. So a lot of meat processors, for example, will use ground mustard as a protein extension, and actually as a means to emulsify the, you know, whether we like to, you know, think about it or not. I mean, something like a hot dog is effectively an emulsified meat product, and it depends on these functional characteristics of again being able to bind, you know, the water and oil, so that there's no oil kind of dripping out of the meat product. As far as dressings and sauces are concerned, it certainly does have a flavor impact from a spice standpoint. So, majority of barbecue sauces, creamy dressings and sauces, again, including mayonnaise, they all use mustard for whether it's a flavor enhancer or, again, for those emulsification properties.
So it's going into products that we may not even realize because we just think of mustard as a condiment. But what you're saying is that it is so much more than a condiment.
Oh, absolutely. It's used, again, its versatility is quite pronounced. I mean, it ranges, without kind of disclosing any specific confidential information, it ranges from a number of very, very, very high visibility products that, you know, people I don't think would necessarily know includes mustard in it. It runs the gamut of creamy sauces, and it's because these different types of mustard, there are multiple types of mustard seed. You know, we look at, you know, Dijon mustard, which uses a lot of brown mustard because of its pungent and very flavorful contributions. Then there's, you know, yellow mustard seed, which is, as you can imagine, used in yellow mustard. But just a kind of a fun fact with the yellow mustard seed, you know, yellow mustard isn't yellow from the yellow mustard seed. Actually, yellow mustard seed kind of generates a white, pasty material. It's yellow because of the turmeric that colors it yellow. But and then there's another type of mustard that is oriental mustard, which has, you know, nothing to do with the region. It's just a type of mustard seed that is grown in Canada and is typically used in, you know, I think the most easy way to explain it is, you know, hot Chinese mustard, right? We, you know, order Chinese food and you get the hot Chinese mustard packets. That's what an oriental mustard flavor would be, that very pungent kind of a horseradish type flavor. So, you know, as you can imagine, there's, you know, a number of food manufacturers who are looking for dry milled mustard products to either serve as a flavor component or, again, some of these other functional contributions that I talked about, or a combination thereof.
Ellen Sass with us leads Wisconsin Spice Incorporated, a manufacturer of mustard products. We're learning about giving us a view into an industry that has been plagued by shortages in extreme weather conditions, hurting the harvest in Canada, other compounding factors. Join in how you use mustard, what you want to know about it as an ingredient in food products, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As we talk mustard, it's definitely worth noting that the National Mustard Museum is in Middleton and is home to the world's largest collection of mustards, more than 6,500. They've been a museum for over 13 years now and celebrated National Mustard Day earlier this month. Join in with your mustard manufacturing questions, tips for using mustard as a condiment or an ingredient in recipes, types of mustard that suits your palate, and why. 800-642-1234. Ellen Sass is here, president of Wisconsin Spice, and stays with us. Let's bring on Joe in Waukesha. Joe, what would you like to bring up?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I love mustard as the condiment, but let's not forget the mighty mustard green. That when you grow from the seed, you get some delicious flavor, especially as a sprout or as young leaf. And we all enjoy it in salads, or I grow microgreens myself. And just wanted to see if the speaker could talk to that, growing them as well as using them as a condiment.
Joe, thank you for that. Alan?
Yeah, good question, Joe. The mustard greens, to my understanding, are not necessarily, overly interrelated with the actual mustard seed crop that we're actually talking about for condiment mustard production. I would be lying if I said I'm overly well-versed with the mustard greens market, but I have heard no impact of any shortage or any impact to the actual, complimentary garnish of mustard greens.
How do you like to take your mustard? I mean, I'm sure you're a mustard aficionado. What types are best for what?
Really good question. Well, it depends. I mean, really, it depends if you're doing home cooking, such as, sauce preparation. Typically, I use mustard most commonly, actually, as a ingredient in making homemade sauces. Particularly, I'll use Dijon in, preparing lamb and other meat dishes. So I'm a bit partial to Dijon mustard. I like to be a little more, I would say, have a little more pungency with the mustards I do consume. But really, it all depends on the application and how much mustard you want to, whether it's complement only from an acidity standpoint, because, mm-hmm. I mean, with yellow mustard, for example, I mean, the most pronounced flavor perceives with yellow mustard is actually the vinegar, right? That's the most forward flavor with it. So it depends if one is looking for an acidity balance and doesn't want a lot of pungency or any other, I would say, noise within the flavor experience. But another great one that is I believe a bit overlooked at times is these sweet and hot mustards, which, mm-hmm. Going back years, decades ago, I know there was a much bigger market for it than there are these days, and I can't necessarily put my finger as to why. But again, these there's so much versatility with getting something. When we say hot with mustard, we're talking about, again, kind of that hot Chinese type flavor profile where it's very, very horseradish-like, and complementing that with whether it's honey, sugar, or any other source of sweetness. So I would say, again, these sweet and hot mustards and Dijons are the ones I go to the most.
One of my favorite things is taking one of those hot Bavarian big pretzels and dipping it into a really nice dark type grainy mustard. Yep. And that's not expert, all, but that's just my favorite way.
and those Bavarian mustards are actually exactly what, it's interesting you say that, Kate, because those Bavarian mustards are actually exactly what I was saying, that they're made with the brown mustard seeds. So again, they have a bit more of the pungency than your yellow mustard. Those brown mustard seeds, again, are a little more typical of a Dijon mustard. But most Bavarian mustards actually do have quite a bit of either sugar or honey added to them as well as for for that sweetness balance.
Well, Carol from Westport called in, couldn't stay with us, has a related family question. They said that, wanted to bring up there's the invasive species of wild mustard that we see growing in Wisconsin, and wondering if that type of wild mustard could be used in any commercial processes.
Wild mustard is actually a problem, for lack of a better description there, with even the crops that's grown in North America for commercial applications. It actually is a defect, if you will, when grading mustard seed and when sourcing it. The wild mustard is certainly not something that would be, I think, well-received from a commercial standpoint, just due to its, I would say, both its color and then also the flavor it imparts, because it certainly is a defect when we're actually looking at mustard seed quality from year to year.
We're talking about mustard seeds with Alan Sass. He's head of Wisconsin Spice, and the company is based in Berlin. You can join in on the mustard industry. Questions you have about mustard as an ingredient, 800-642-1234. Alan, you mentioned that you deliver your products to dozens of countries, six continents. Has the global supply chain, the challenge of moving products in and out of ports, container shortages, all of that, has that been difficult for your business to navigate?
It has. It is very real, the logistical challenges, and I would say just the lack of equipment is what it comes down to. When I say equipment, I mean just these containers are just are unavailable. And, you know, when we think about these, you know, shipping internationally, shipping globally, I mean, it's a global network, right? We're all interrelated on that. And if, you know, any country or any market, you know, whether, you know, most obviously, I mean, we can most commonly point to China for this, as far as having, you know, their impact on container supply. So when there are lack of movements or there is a lack of movement in any country, there's another country that's awaiting these containers, and we can't get our hands on them. So it is very real. I know that, you know, earlier this year with some of the shutdowns that, you know, China put into place, I think I recently read that Shanghai, I think, accounts for 10% of the containers in the world move through one port. And, you know, when that gets shut down, it certainly has a profound impact. Then, you know, that on top of an ongoing shortage of drivers as well, which is really been one of these mounting. This, we can go back 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, and I think we all kind of saw the writing on the wall, in fact, that there was a real problem with a lack of logistical support. So, you know, you compound all this, and things just aren't moving. And it's, you know, I mean, we do a lot of business in the UK, for example, and when we're, you know, talking the market in the UK, we regularly hear that there's a driver shortage, you know. So think about just, you know, let's just assume things are just moving between the UK and the US, which is, you know, obviously not the case. But if things are just, you know, moving between the UK and the US, you know, if things are unable to move in one country, that means obviously things are being stuck in that country and containers aren't coming back to the U.S. Of course, that's just a small example. That
domino effect.
You know, we can multiply that or magnify that around the world. And it is a real problem. It's not uncommon for shipments to be waiting, you know, up to a month to find either a driver or equipment to be able to haul these goods internationally. So it really is a problem. And it's, you know, while we're talking about, you know, the mustard seed shortage, you know, this crop year is we're in the middle of harvesting it. There's about another 3 to 4 weeks left of harvesting this year. And it's all indications are that there'll be a correction. I think supplies will remain tight. We had another year of sub average yields. It certainly was not a great growing year, but thankfully, you know, going back to my earlier point, the market supported growers. We really incentivized them to plant mustard. There was if not a record, certainly the from my trending and my tracking, one of the largest years that I've ever seen as far as acreage.
Well, Alan, thank you for joining us and giving us a glimpse of the industry.
Not a problem, Kate.
Alan Sass, president of Wisconsin Spice Incorporated, based in Berlin, manufactures mustard products for commercial, industrial, and food service settings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.